Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Claire Madeline Culkin, and I'm your host. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Susan Cavalier Adler, the author of The Anatomy of Regret, From Death Instinct to Reparation and Symbolization Through Vivid Case Studies. Susan, hello and welcome.
Hello.
It's great to have you
here.
Yes, it's great to have you. So I wanted to speak to you about the title of your book, which is the first thing that really sold me on doing this interview and getting acquainted with your theory, The Anatomy of Regret. That's such a brilliant title. Where did you come up with it?
Well, it really came through a very visceral, deep, personal gut feeling of regret that I went through myself, and I'm connecting my gut feelings of the kind of agony that one's a major regret one feels in relation to hurting the one you love, which is Melanie Klein's view of the depressive position, pain of loss and guilt. I encapsulate that in idea more interpersonally overall in the idea of regret, which encompasses loss and guilt, as she said, in the depressive position. So it was a personal experience of both heart and gut kind of feelings of agony, very visceral and emotional at the same time, and very much within a relationship. And actually, I came upon the idea of and actually writing about it and making a book out of it, both through, of course, seeing the pivotal moments of these feeling levels of deep feeling of regret in patients, which the book became, that became the subject of the book. But I also had one particular moment where, and this is interesting historically, that I was watching Clinton, President Clinton, on television when the whole Monica Lewinsky scandal started breaking, and he was on TV saying at that point that he regretted what he did. But my husband immediately said, "Oh, he doesn't feel regret. He's just angry that he was caught." And what was so interesting about that was because even though I think he was right about Clinton at that moment, he wasn't actually feeling that kind of regret that I, because I heard him talking about regret, my own sense of regret, which was like a fresh wound inside of me, was triggered, and I started like really sobbing and feeling the depth of this pain about hurting the one you love. And so I was feeling that while I watched Clinton, and my husband commented that he wasn't actually feeling it. So the whole idea of false versus true regret came up at that moment. And then I wanted to write a book about true regret and the existential experience of regret that brings actual psychic change. And beyond moments of change, it can actually be part of a whole change in character structure in this in the mental makeup of a personality through pivotal moments of regret. I had had an article that I once published in a journal on psychoanalytic review on pivotal moments of surrender to mourning the parental internal object. So that was about pivotal moments of transformation also toward within developmental mourning, which is my overall theory, and of loss and guilt, and also aggression leading to those deeper feelings of sadness when one can symbolize and contain aggression. So that pivotal moments was in that article, but then in this book, it's like pivotal around the actual experience of regret within a mourning process in a clinical treatment. And my patient speaks so poetically because they were in the feeling so acutely at the moment.
Right.
I write about.
So the idea kind of came out of the visceral experience of regret. And so you understood that regret has a kind of anatomy to it. It has a kind of structure, as though the psychic structure evolves from this very embodied feeling and develops from pivotal moments in working through that bodily experience of regret.
Right. Yeah. So and to that point, I think my title, Anatomy of Regret, although I didn't think of it that way at the time, I thought of, you know, anatomy of an idea, and that the idea of regret as a concept and what I call psychic regret. So the title was Anatomy of that idea. But then there's also the anatomy related to the actual visceral experience of the body. That's part of regret. So it's part of our anatomy in that sense too. So I think that was a good word to have in the title there.
Yeah. You know, it's impossible to think about your book without thinking about the cases that structure it. The cases, as I was reading it, I'm not particularly familiar with Kleinian psychoanalytic theory, although it was interesting to see how you position Kleinian theory alongside Freudian analytic theory in order to get to this idea of developmental mourning and psychic regret that belongs to you and that you talk about throughout the book. So I kind of really relied on the case studies in navigating my way through as a reader. And I found that as you theoretically map the anatomy of these psychoanalytic ideas, in particular, you draw from both Sigmund Freud, Anna Freud, as well as Klein and then Fairbairn, you kind of piece them together or take them apart. You kind of disassemble them in order to find where their limits are. When do they stop making sense in relationship to what you're seeing in your clinical encounter? And so it's at that moment when the cases intervene. And so your ideas, the anatomy of your ideas, are very much advanced by these cases, by the bodies of the having these experiences of regret. Their bodies speak where theory stops providing us with an intelligible, you know, language.
Yes, well, I like the fact that as a reader and a reader that wasn't so familiar with the theory, that you have told me that you were able to take in so much of the theory through the clinical process, and that that was very gratifying to hear, because everything I write theoretically and as many theories as I take apart and put back together through integrating them with my framework of developmental mourning, the aim is always to inform myself as a clinician and others about clinical treatment and the critical clinical moments within a process of clinical treatment. And the theory speaks through moments and through the patient's own voice. Mm-hmm. So I think this, particularly because it's so clinical and so many in-depth, you know, clinical cases, show the sea through the experience of the person in therapy at that point, therapy mm-hmm. and psychoanalysis.
Mm-hmm. Would you be able to introduce... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. No, just and mourning within a therapeutic process.
Right. Would you be able to explain for our listeners a little bit of this idea of developmental mourning?
Yes, of course. Well, first of all, I want to emphasize that it's an affect theory, or we say affect means feelings. So it's a theory about feelings, visceral, emotional, all together, and heart and stomach, which has different kinds of feelings. But it's a theory of ultimately getting to grief and loss in order to move forward a developmental process from where it may have been stopped by a loss that hasn't been mourned. So when one moves forward, one opens up love and the capacity to connect with the ones in the external world, the move towards intimacy and relatedness with both love and anger and love and hate, and move towards internalizations that come from others that nurture us developmentally, too, through relationships. So all that opens up through the person surrendering their defenses against the pain of loss, because we all defend against it because it's painful, especially at first when there's been a lot of accumulated pain from blocked loss or unmourned losses. Once the bit by bit in therapy, the defenses can be surrendered to connect with loss, then one can surrender to opening up love. But in order to get to loss, there also has to be overall more love than hate. So you have to deal with aggression as part of this affect process, as part of the developmental process that you see through feelings or affects. So the interesting thing now going back historically is that Sigmund Freud, of course, believed that in Mourning and Melancholia, he talked about the difference between someone who can mourn, and he was talking about just mourning loss. He didn't deal with aggression at all in the mourner, versus the melancholic who's stuck with their aggression, turning it against the self, and blocks the potential to mourn. Mm. What he didn't deal with was how aggression could become part of a mourning process. Melanie Klein does deal with that in 1940 after Freud's paper in 1917. Klein deals with it in 1940 in Mourning and its relation to manic depressive states. And there she uses herself as Mrs. A, mourning her son, because Melanie Klein did lose her adult son, Hans. And she was actually using herself as a clinical example and went through her own process of mourning. And through doing that, she showed that her own hostile aggression towards her son that went back to her more primal objects in her internal world, to her brother and mother who were there instead of her, and then were again connected internally with her feelings about her son, that there was competitiveness, hostility about being alive and triumphing over him, her dead son, with contempt. And there was all this aggression mm-hmm. towards him that went back to her brother and her mother. And there had been a lot of envy. And all this was brought to a symbolic level through her taking apart dreams she had with these kind of thoughts, these hostile thoughts towards her son. And by symbolizing them, you know, having the dream images appear after the first shock of her loss, her dream life opened up, her psychic fantasy opened up, and she then was aware that she had this aggressive attitudes towards her son that went back to her mother and brother. And as she sorted that out, she became consciously aware of her own aggression. She therefore had a symbolic understanding through the images of the dreams and understanding through conscious words in her own mind what she was angry about towards them or what her hostility was about. She was able, through symbolizing that in words, she was able to contain her aggression or her hate, and therefore was able to then feel, have space to feel her love towards her son, and that's when she could surrender to the grief of loss. And the word surrender is very important. It's one I've used also for Argentine tango, but that's another story. But that's also heart, so I bring it in because it's heart to heart all the time. But surrender is, surrendering to grief and loss is something that comes when one's containing the aggression that has blocked one from feeling loss. Once you surrender your aggressive defenses and your aggressive attitudes, you can then surrender to pure loss and grief, which is what Freud was talking about in Mourning and Melancholia, when he just emphasized loss and the adhesiveness and the pain of letting go of the object as the whole thing of mourning. And, you know, he saw that as the whole deal. So with Klein, it's more complex, but more related to what our daily experience of mourning is, and especially in mourning primal losses, that there's a lot of ambivalence, there's a lot of mixture, love and hate and unspoken anger and resentments and attitudes of contempt and hostility, sometimes envy, and all these things that Klein spoke about. Once we're conscious of them, they're no longer destructive. We don't have to act them out. Then we can just have words for them and ideas, and that's how we contain them and move towards love again. So it's a renewal of love. Mourning and grieving, which is the affect grief, is a process of a renewing and opening up love. So we can often talk about it as a rebirthing of the self in an emotional sense, because we open up the primal capacity to love and relate, and of course to, through that, have intimacy, and through that to internalize good relations with others to build a more solid internal self and a more loving internal world. So it all works together in that way. So that's all part of my developmental mourning. Mm-hmm. But I also, I'm now speaking about from Freud to Klein to myself, but I also do integrate within that D.W. Winnicott's idea of object survival, how the therapist survives the most primal aggression of the patient, allows the patient to then begin to symbolize their aggression and contain it and then to mourn. And so his concept leads into Klein's concept of mourning, and there's a dialectic there, which I've written about in my book on Klein, Winnicott dialectic, but it goes from dealing with aggression in therapy with the analyst surviving it to the patient then able to surrender to grief through having their aggression survive, can contain it, and it mm-hmm. symbolize it so it isn't destructive, then love is renewed. So Winnicott comes into this, and they integrate the American theorists like James Masterson, who built on Margaret Mahler's theory of separation, along with Althea Horner, who built on that theory of Mahler and separation individuation. And Masterson talked about an abandonment depression in those who have developmental arrest in the separation individuation phases, and what Winnicott would call the transitional stage of development. Mm-hmm. And so Masterson talks about very powerful affect states, of void states, empty states, and then rageful states, and eventually more refined anger, getting to loss in somebody who's been developmentally arrested. And so that the grief that we get to then allows for a separation individuation to take place that hasn't taken place, and which has arrested the person in what we call a personality disorder or character disorder.
Right.
But everyone has losses, whether they have that rest at that stage or not. And in therapy and object relations therapy and psychoanalysis, I always work towards always whatever the primal loss is, even if it was Oedipal disillusionment. Like Charlotte Bronte, who's I wrote about it in one of my books, The Compulsion to Create. Her disillusionment was the Oedipal stage, her loss. Her sister, Emily Brontë, it was pre-Oedipal. And when the mother died and she got arrested in separation individuation. So it's getting to the primal loss. But with the character disorder, the whole personality it lacks integration because of the arrest and separation individuation. So there it's absolutely necessary to heal the self and have a whole self that could continue development to have a mourning process. So it's important in everybody, but it's critical to character disorders to move forward developmentally and right. self-integrate. So self-integration and separation individuation overlap, and through the mourning process, both are accomplished. And then all the ego functions just organically open up, which you don't have to think like ego psychology, how do we deal with the patient's functioning? Because we don't have to deal with their functioning, because these ego capacities that help them function evolve organically through the affect focus on the mourning process and the affect experience of the mourning process and treatment. Mm-hmm. So observing self-reflection, a capacity for ambivalence, capacity for consciousness, psychic conflict, for capacity to have a dialectic between different parts of the self, good and bad, love and hate, feminine, masculine, psychic dialectic, all these things, along with observing ego, self-reflection, and all the ways that we develop to function in the world are developed organically through the mourning process. So the affect focus allows these the other things to develop without a particular focus on the functioning of the ego. It happens organically through the object relations work and the developmental mourning process, as I'm describing. So I take from the American school and the British school in my thinking about what I see with my patients in this mourning process opening up.
Right. One of the things that I experienced as a reader is that the way that you position all of these different theories, these different aspects of these different theories that come together in the way that they address, in some way, the mourning process, everything always comes down to the body, and it always comes down to aggression, and it always comes down to the way in which we deal with aggression by symbolizing it in some way. I like very much something that you had said early on in your book. You write, when Freud declares that the shadow of the object fell upon the ego, essentially he is saying that the shadow of the parent's personality falls upon the self.
Right.
When you were talking earlier, just a minute ago, you were talking about this idea of surrendering to the loss, that in the surrendering of the loss, there was a renewal and a rebirth. And when you say renewal, I think of vows, I think of words, I think of speech. And when you say rebirth, yeah. I think of birth, I think of the body. When you reference Freud in this way, hold on, I just have to unlock my computer. It just locked up. When you reference Freud in this way, and you talk about how the shadow of the, you interpret what he's saying when he says the shadow of the object fell upon the ego, you're talking about bodies as becoming incorporated into one another on a symbolic level that language allows us to access.
Right. And yes. And I've written very much about the visceral feelings the patients have through their own voice, but sometimes describing them myself, sometimes just hearing it through the patients. And, you know, there may be, like, in the Sharon, the first chapter, there's something I could read there about where you get that sense of how totally psychophysical the whole experience of the critical turning point of regret is. And in each case I have, you have those pivotal turning points towards renewed development and renewed capacity to love, mm-hmm. and actual psychic structure change of the personality to undo the identification with the aggressor that was turned against the self or the other, and to then liberate aggression for healthy self-assertiveness and self ambition and love and relatedness with aggression as a healthy part of love, sexuality, and all that. And we are liberated from the destructive aggression.
Right.
So that happens as is symbolized and as grief renews the opening up to love. And it is a very body level experience. And I think you can see that in all the cases. And there are also the cases there of a man and a woman who go through regret about extramarital affairs and then renew their, you mentioned the word vows, they actually renew their vows to loved one, their mate, their spouse, and they commit to marriage in a more full way than they've ever been able to do before.
Mm-hmm.
So that also shows the couple's relationship aspect of this growing through the person's individual work in their internal world. Other aspects I talk about, tolerable and intolerable regret. And of course, that does, how does that take place in the body? In an article I had, a chapter I had called Vaginal Core, Vampire Mouth, Visceral Level of Envy in Women. Third part of it was Progress, Symbolic Politics of Object Relations, a long title, but it was a chapter in a book called Gender and Envy. And it was, edited by Nancy Burke, a religious book in 1999, chapter on Vaginal Core, Vampire Mouth, shows both in Sylvia Plath, one of the writers that I've also written about in my other books on women artists and writers and the compulsion to create and the creative mystique. I write about her versus a patient, or in parallel with a patient I call Miss E, and you can see that the voracious void of the separation, individuation, failing with the mother that was there, that is so, there's so much envy with the hunger because of that early emotional deprivation and the lack of contact and connection with the mother through the separation, individuation phases because of the mother's problems. In both the patient and Sylvia Plath, you see the body in their self-expression and, in my case of my patient, in the treatment room with me, so that her when she was sealed off and her love was split off from her hate, she was also expressing this kind of visceral vampire mouth attack on me with biting attacks on me. And later, when she went through developmental mourning and evolved to a stage of separation individuation that got her to the higher Oedipal stage, and at that point there was body stuff about erotic attraction to me, but I wasn't just a breaster anymore, I was a woman with breasts that she attracted to. And then, as she could feel her erotic desires and kind of own her vaginal core, she was no longer had to act out through her vampire mouth, biting towards me, emotionally biting me. So there was actually shift from the oral attack to the vaginal core containment of the woman as she developed into a woman. And in Sylvia Plath, you see the little girl in her that never got to really evolve into a woman because her mourning process failed, partly because she never got into any adequate therapy and unfortunately had been given shock treatment and ended up repeating the suicidal pattern that was her demise. But before her suicide, she wrote some of her most viscerally alive, body-oriented therapy in her aerial poems. And there's one poem, Daddy, which I've articulated many times in presentations on the dark side of creativity. And it's very body-oriented in her little girl self saying in the first stanza, You do not do black shoe, in which I've lived like a foot for 30 years, poor and white, barely able to breathe that shoe. So the body is there right away, but that's like the little girl's expression of being sealed off. In her novel, she wrote about the bell jar, being sealed off in a bell jar. Mm-hmm. But in this poem, the body sealing off was there. And in my patient that I have in parallel in that chapter on vaginal cord versus vampire mouth, you see how my patient can evolve from that arrested, sealed off state into a full expression of interpersonal erotic desire that had contact and connection in it. And that came through reaching that surrender to the grief affects after the biting aggression was contained through understanding of the hunger underneath it that she was expressing towards me. And I experienced a lot of it through her putting stuff into me through projective identification, me becoming her battering ram, which then in a dream became the metallic breast, but she became the metallic breast mother, killing an infant by shoving a metallic breast into the infant. So in the therapy, she felt like she was the infant, I was the metallic breast that she called the battering ram. And in her dream, it was the reverse. She was the metallic breast killing the infant. So it was two parts of her, the mother-infant components were... So I've gone on quite a bit about that.
Well, that's okay, because I think that there's something, you know, there's something in that that kind of reoccurs in the cases throughout your book that has to do with this splitting off. And if we go back to Freud and the way that you explained him earlier, in Melancholia, or in his paper, Mourning and Melancholia, he talks about how when we lose somebody else, it's not just the loss of the other, it's also the loss of the part of ourself that was in the other. So there's this way in which bodies become incorporated into one another and separated from one another, and we have to reconcile in that. We have to reconcile that in some way in order to
just function as a
self. You had said that earlier. You had said that when you're going to deal with mourning, when you're going to face loss, you always have to deal with the primal or the internal object, partly because external objects may not always be present or agreeable in working through
right.
this process, and partly also because it's the way in which this internal object has become a part of our anatomy, the anatomy of our psyche and our psychic structure that we really have to work with. So when you talk about the splitting off of my body and the body of the other, and you also talk about the reparations that need to take place through symbolization in these profound bodily turning points, we're talking again about this relationship between the body and language. Once the body is put into play in a symbolic space. And I'm wondering if maybe here we can bring the conversation to focus on the case of Sharon that features prominently in everything that we've been discussing about your book. Would you be able to introduce a little bit about the case?
I'd like to read a passage from where it is, that pivotal turning point, because it also is in... my observation of that and her own words. I also want to mention that in the case of June that I have in a Routledge book from 2003 called Mourning, Spirituality, and Psychic Change, I talk about critical point where she has a dream where the mother's body separates out from her body, and that's very much related to the transference with me at that point. So in me being in the maternal transference, she dreams that, and I go from feeling her feelings with her, like even my lungs expand and her lungs open up, to having very different feelings from her after she has that dream, because it's a literal dream defining this differentiation and separation of her body and her mother's body, and therefore I no longer feel through projective identification her, me being like part and parcel of her, my body and her body, and I start to have different feelings in my body than in her body at that point. Mm-hmm. So the dream actually defines that point. And there are things about my body as a therapist, too, because I open breathing with another person in that book, Morning Spirituality and Psychic Change. And my breathing opens. I intuitively sense I need to open my breathing so this woman on the couch could experience her most vulnerable infant love and tender feelings towards her mother and express it to me and a transference in towards me at that moment. Only when I opened up my breathing could she stay with such intense vulnerability. I made the psychic space in a bodily way that way.
Right.
So yes, in the case of Sharon, we can go to that. She was someone who was very sealed off in a what we call a schizoid way and opened up through the treatment through imagery and dreams first and then through the affect experience. Can I read you to a few lines from there that involve this critical turning point?
Yeah, absolutely. First, I think it's important to just introduce to listeners who haven't read the book that something that makes Sharon interesting is that she was a writer, and partly she came... Correct me if I'm misreading the book or getting this incorrect as I talk about it. But partly she came to treatment because in her writing, her male characters were never believable. They just seemed like reductionistic kind of caricatures of men, but not real humans.
Right.
So the way that you know, there's always this. Either you're in the book when you go through your cases at these pivotal turning points, you're either giving voice to their bodily grief by describing it, which you do in incredibly poetic ways that I just find myself connecting, you know, connecting with on such a kind of an intimate level. It's like I know these people now at this point. But in this case, what's so special is that Sharon actually gives voice to herself. Her own words can become a part of this case, and you allow that in the telling of the story. So I just think that's interesting for listeners to kind of know about before you go ahead and read.
Yes. She came in, and there was tremendous conscious rage at her mother, who I called like a Medusa-like witch mother. She called her that, you know, the monster mother. And rage at her father because he became this passive invalid later in her life and he never stood up to the mother who was abusing her. But, and so then when she was writing, she wasn't a full-time writer. Later she hoped to become one, but she had a full-time job, but she was writing plays, and the feedback that she got was that the male characters just didn't hold up. They were like caricatures. And she came to me because of the compulsion to create book I wrote and about the father and the mother, the disruption of the father and the demon love of the father. And she couldn't see a father as a demon till later. She started to see that. She felt he was demonic in being so passive, but she actually wrote him about him in a way that just lacked any sense of who he was in the inside, mm-hmm. And that's why her plays were turned down. So she came to me also as a writer because I do work with writing groups and I do individual. I work with a lot of writers. Written books on writers, and I work with writing in the creative process and individually and in treatment and in individual consults and groups. So she came as a writer in that sense. And the father was to come alive through this critical, pivotal moment of regret. And that's when, for the first time, I call this passage in the case in the Anatomy of Regret, Regrets for Daddy. And I want to read a little bit of it because I want to show you right now the actual pivotal moment of that filling transformation that goes on through consciousness of regret, which I call psychic regret, meaning consciousness of one's regret. So I'll just read this, and it's related to the father who she had so detached from. I say, this session is memorable for its dialectical poles of hate and love, spinning around a father object who had been coming increasingly to life as part object forms come to whole object forms as the self and psyche integrate. By the midpoint of this session, Sharon was recalling the hate for a father who epitomized all the forms of failing her, which left her feeling alone and like an alien in her family. Her rage came awake, and she felt it as this fire, like she was on fire. But then, another transformation. There was hate, hate, hate. Then suddenly something erupted from another plane as a new regret consumed her. Sharon's syncopated memory jumped forward from childhood to her adulthood as she recalled how he had written to her, her father that is, asking to see her, saying it might be the last time they saw each other. With this thought, Sharon started to cry in great gulps of pain that was different from other times of silent weeping. "He knew he was going to die," she said. "I didn't believe him. I wrote him back a snide, contemptuous, and dismissive letter, saying that, of course, we'd see each other again. I can feel the sneer in the letter now. I was the cold, detached, sadistic one then, not he, not her. I was the metallic object, the unfeeling stone. I never saw him again." As she said this, Sharon doubly erupted in an agony of grief. She gasped to breathe as her tears flooded her and wiped out the hot wires of hate that had possessed her. A new level of memory entered the door of my consultation room, a level of memory that neither of us had witnessed before. Sharon remembered an early daddy that she had kept immured in the darkness of her mental closet up until that very moment. He was a daddy who she now, in this very moment, believed had truly loved her. "I never believed that my mother loved me," she said, "but I always knew my father had loved me. I forgot all of it. The daddy who loved me, the daddy I loved." Her tears washed her eyes red. I could only see them when she got up from the couch at the end of the session. She concludes, "I was so mean, I turned my heart cold. No wonder my first marriage failed and I almost destroyed my second." As her analyst, I felt the poignancy of the moment as Sharon's heart cried out to me with her newfound capacity to love. We had discovered her daddy. I wanted to sing as her grief washed up on the raft of her core self. When Sharon left the session that day, we both knew that change could definitely happen. "He really loved me," she repeated. Seeing her father as a vulnerable being has allowed Sharon to dream of a vulnerable mother with hurt in her eyes. The new image of her mother, allowing her to see the child in her mother, has allowed her to relinquish the image of her mother as a monster. Okay, so that's mm-hmm. basically it, that visceral, anguished, and pivotal turning point of feeling and affect.
It's of really,
the moment of
it's really a moment of not just, it's a moment of self-acceptance that turns into a moment of acceptance of the other, the split off bad parts of the other.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, and that only can happen. That only can happen through accepting Sharon's own aggression. I mean, she realizes that the aggressions that she was kind of navigating, coming from her mother, had become internalized and become a model or a mechanism in her relationship to the world. And so there's such a close. Again, it's we get back to bodies. There's such an intimate relationship between between bodies, not just physical bodies, but also psychic bodies. Our anatomy is so similar to it's so intricately and inextricably bound with the psychic body of the person who bore us. And I just found it really moving that there's this moment of recognition of kind of sameness. And so through her therapy, she can have compassion for herself. And then she can also have compassion for her mother by seeing her also in the position of a child.
Yes, yes. Her compassion and empathy grow. When I've written, I had articles called Neurotic Guilt to Existential Guilt is Grief, leading to, and I talk about leading to compassion, concern, interiority, the inner self and inner world opening up into consciousness. All these things develop through this pivotal moments within mourning, surrender to grief, and here specifically to regret. And you can see in my description that I talk about the heart there. I talk about, you know, her gasping for breath, her eyes turning. It's very, very body, her body, and my sense of it as I'm with her, and my own feelings of the deep feelings with her. So, yes, it's very much body, and it reminds me of when you talked about of being born. I have an article actually called Divine, the Deviant and the Diabolical that was once in the International Forum of Psychoanalysis Journal, and then I put it at the end of the Morning Spirituality and Psychic Change book, which was a Routledge book in 2003. And it's about a woman artist who, through her paintings, you can see the very visceral body stuff that went on in her mourning process as she, for the first time, felt she was being born. And she would talk about being born in the paintings, and you could see it. And I also think of another patient talk about a primal dream she had that we went back to again and again because it was about how her mother's body could not contain her and she was spilling out. So she had to kind of find a container and be reborn through the treatment process.
See, this
way, yes, it's very much about psychic birth and viscerally and emotionally experienced together.
This way that you describe your patients describing their own experience is interesting to me, in that there's always a way in which they're looking for a metaphor to describe their bodily experience. Like when we talk about the mother that can't contain me, we're talking about the way in which my body cannot be incorporated as a part of the mother's body. The body is this point of this boundary or this limit over which things can overflow, this brim kind of. The way in which we use language is to create a symbolic structure for talking about the way that our bodies relate to one another, with which we can do something more. We can do something with this metaphor psychically that allows our relationship to ourselves and to others to change. That's something that I think I'm seeing as being consistent throughout each of your cases in this book, as well as in the cases that you're referencing here that exist in your writing elsewhere.
Yes, the patient begins to have a sense of agency through using metaphor, that they then feel they have an understanding of their self and how their process operates. So the metaphor a birth becomes a whole way of experiencing life then, of when one's opening up to renewing oneself, opening up to contact connection and nurturing new internalizations through that too for continued development, or when they're closing off from that and they learn about all the ways they close off from that and their habits in doing that from a lifetime. And so, yeah, the metaphor of birth or of hiding away in a womb, and because of their fears and defining what their fears are, the metaphor of birth becomes a whole constellation.
Right. I just would like to begin the closing of our interview, I suppose, with a quote from your book. You write, "It is our wish to love that makes us human. It is our longing for one another and our highly aggressive conflicts around loving that force us to grow in the human psychic and spiritual struggle." I think that really speaks to what you understand so well about your patients as people experiencing something universal about human suffering. You say that it's extremely important for personality disordered individuals or individuals with character structure problems to go through this mourning process, but it's not something that's exclusive to them. It's arrested in particular ways that are particularly detrimental, but it's a part of everybody's experiences. It's a spiritual and human experience. It's a human experience right. to have that trauma, and it's a spiritual experience to be reborn out of it through some kind of therapeutic growth.
Right. Yes, absolutely. I use the word existential guilt as grief, going from neurotic guilt to existential guilt as grief in some articles of mine in the American Journal of Psychoanalysis, and that came together. We recently had a conference on guilt, conscience, reparation, and regret, two Sundays ago, and from my institute, the Object Relations Institute, and there Donald Cravath and I were talking about these things in somewhat parallel terms. He talked about going from the persecutory superego to conscience, which relates to the heart. I talk about going from is neurotic guilt, which is related to that persecutory guilt, to existential guilt as grief, which relates to reparative guilt. And so we were talking in parallel terms, and we were both talking about the heart, and therefore I also perform Argentine Tango, which is our heart-to-heart, to show that moment of improvisation of life, where heart-to-heart, where you are open to connection and contact, when you're not living in a sealed-off state. But we have the character disorders that are really, so much of them is unborn, and then we have others who are born who have to mourn loss in order to become more and more fully human and to face and contain their fears and move towards more containment and more relationship and intimacy and commitment through the love being renewed. And so, again, going back to the affect level of containing hate as part of the human condition, rage, aggression, but containing it, symbolizing it, to transform aggression towards healthy relating, self-assertion, self-containment, and then love can develop along with creativity. So love and creativity develop, they can get blocked in the same way, or they can they do get blocked in the same way, and they open up also through the mourning process, both the creative self-expression and love. In fact, my theory of psychic health, which I stated most explicitly in my book, The Creative Mystique, From Red Shoes Frenzy to Love and Creativity, it's a book about women artists and writers and the creative process and the mourning process. It goes hand in hand with The Compulsion to Create and Women Writers and Their Demon Lovers. Those were published in Routledge in 1993 and 1996, but now we're republished by ORI Academic Press. And The Creative Mystique, which has a red ballet slipper on the cover for the Red Shoes theme, and this has Suzanne Farrell in New York City Ballet with Balanchine in there. It also has my theory of psychic health, and there's a chapter on the creative process and psychic health. And I talk about the love-creativity dialectic, which is that when we're whole and open and we have that sufficient self-integration and separation individuation, we naturally flow from connection with ourself for our own self-expression, which can become our creative work and creative process and artistic work or just creative work. We go from that self-connection organically to love or connection through relationship with the external other through intimacy, and back and forth. Intimacy renews us. We get nurturance through external relationship, love and intimacy, to enhance and keep developing the internal self, which then we have our more creative resources. So when we're healthy, we go back and forth from self-connection to other connection, and from other connection, we then need to go back into ourselves, and we take nurturance inside. When we create and express ourselves, we also allow for an opening to the other that allows for intimacy. So it goes back and forth. In conditions like what I call the compulsion to create, where someone seals off because of traumatic relationships and gives up on them and tries to live in the creative process, kind of there's no nurturance from the outside. Even the creativity of the most brilliant women writers that I've written about dry up. So there. That compulsion to create is the other side of writing blocks, which I deal with all the time. It's when the artist's living all the time in their internal womb of compulsion to create and feeding on itself from the outside, from the inside, and not going out and getting nurturance in relationship. And that tends to happen in character disorder, and often brilliant artists have had those character disorders and demonstrate this in their work, which I was showing in the compulsion to create and the creative mystique. So there's that, there's that, and the writing blocks seem to happen with more neurotic people who have repression. They don't live in the creative process. They have trouble sometimes expressing their creative resources because of their, often defenses against their aggression, but they have repression. So instead of letting it all pour out in their work, like someone with the compulsion to create, externalizing the internal world, the internal pain, just letting it pour out, they repress things, so then they get writer's blocks rather than living in the creative process and the compulsion to create. It's two opposite sides of a problem. But the healthy side is having motivated creativity, not the compulsion and not the block, but rather a free motivation to create. And that free motivation to write or create is comes from a dialectical interaction with the capacity to love and love the other and have intimacy and get nurturance through that to internalize for one's inner self and one's self-connection, one's creative process. Mm-hmm. So, and then there's the love addict who can't love, who just always clings to the other and has no sense of her or his internal resources and always is there trying to feel alive through connecting to the other and not being able to connect enough with the inner self because it can be sealed off and needs to open up to relationship. So that those are the two sides of the pathology, the love addict or the compulsion to create, but the health is where there's a free flow from connection with oneself to connection with the other, from creative self-expression to intimate, loving contact with someone that we get to know and love.
Right. So in all of these cases, there are different ways with which we contain ourselves, and there are either fluid boundaries between that, there's some flexibility, or there's not. And I get the sense that it's when the way that we build these containers, so to speak, becomes too rigid and inflexible, too arrested, that we experience just, you know, psychological issues, just relationship issues. It's making those boundaries between self and other more fluid, as well as the relationship between self as other more fluid. It's a very tragic story, all of the ways that we do this to ourselves and to other people, just arrest our relationships and contain ourselves. But it comes with a very hopeful story about rebirth, I think, in the way that you tell it.
Yes, the developmental mourning is a story of rebirth and growth and letting go of the old, opening to the new. So my definition of mourning, while it can encompass bereavement, it's much broader. It's about all of the whole human condition and mourning throughout life as letting go of the old, opening to the new, keeping the system open from this love outside to creative self-connection inside. In tango, Argentine tango, which since I'm an advanced Argentine tango dancer, I always use those metaphors. Mm-hmm. We have connection with the self, the other, and the music. And in the clinical moment with the patient, we as followers with the patient go through the unconscious of the patient. There's the connection with the patients where they are, with the other and with ourself and with the music of what goes on between us in this space in between, what Winnicott calls the transitional space, and the music of the words of the patient that comes through these developmental mourning affects, because you can see how poetic Sharon is, how poetic the patient is in that moment of such in-depth, effective, visceral, and emotional experience all together.
Absolutely. I think that's a beautiful place to end our interview. We are out of time.
Okay.
It has been wonderful speaking with you, Susan, and perhaps we'll have you again at another interview on the New Books Network.
Oh, yes. It would be a pleasure, and perhaps on the Klein-Winnicott dialectic book. Okay.
All right. Thank you so much, Sharon. Susan, I'm so sorry. I'm getting you confused.
Oh, you mean my patient.
All right.
Okay, yes, that was a made-up name anyway, but yes, thank you. Thank you, Claire. It's been a lovely interview. I really appreciate the space and time to express myself so freely about my life's work. Thank you.